When did you move to Minnesota?
1990.
Mm-hmm.
Moved down there to take a job at the university, and a little change of pace.
Yeah. Well, what are you teaching?
Teach Native literature. I chair the American Indian Studies Department at the University of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Against my will, but they needed an administrator, and I didn't want to do it. But when we turned around and looked to see who was eligible to do it, so like musical chairs, and I was the person left standing.
Well, that's interesting. Talk to me a little bit about Native American literature, because I know Native Americans have had, except for the Cherokee in the early days, I think, as I recall, the Cherokee had the only actual written language. Most of the literature would, I would assume, spring from an oral tradition.
Most of it does, and it's true that Cherokee are going to develop a syllabary in the 1800s, primarily to operate a newspaper that was bilingual. It would have Cherokee on one side, English on the other. And it was a means of communication that they developed, I suppose, early on. Other tribes are going to follow suit fairly quickly. But for the most part, the traditions, the literary traditions, are oral. And they're just beginning to wind up in a written form now. Indians have been writing since the late 1800s. But there really hasn't been a kind of explosion of that writing, particularly in fiction, drama, and poetry, till after 1969, I suppose. And that's when Momaday is going to publish Housemaid of Dawn, is going to win the Pulitzer Prize, and then all of us sort of jump on the bandwagon at that point. And you have this proliferation of Native artists who come to the fore in Canada and the U.S.
So your focus, I guess, is primarily contemporary.
My focus is, as a matter of fact, there are hardly any Native writers who do historical material. Just little bits and pieces here. Most all of us write about contemporary issues and set our fictions or our dramas in contemporary periods. Partly, I think, just because that historical period is so full of stereotypes and cliches and has been mulled over by non-Native writers to such a degree that it's kind of hard to set something in the 19th century out on the plains without running into pinto ponies and teepees and Indians running around with feathers. It's like doing, I suppose, a movie about Africa and not having alligators or, you know, those sort of general things that people expect to see there. So it's a period that most of us stay away from.
Well, tell me how your course is structured.
The literature course?
Yeah.
Primarily, I do a little bit of background on oral literature, talk about some of the traditions there and some of the major structures, some of the characters that you're going to see in oral literature, like Trickster. I talk about creation stories and the kinds of ideas that those creation stories posit about the way in which the world is structured. And then I do more or less a historical survey beginning with early novels. Generally, I stay with the novel. Sometimes I do poetry and drama, but primarily I like to use the novel. And I'll start off with something like Mourning Dove's Kogiwia, which is written in, I think, 1929.
And then just work my way through. That would be one of the earliest?
It's not the earliest. There's a book by a fellow named John Roland Ridge, who is Cherokee, who publishes a thing called The Life and Times of the Celebrated California Bandit, Joaquin Murrieta. And that's published in 1850s, I believe, right around there. But there are just maybe one book 20 years, one book 10 years, one book 15 years. You have a few that are published. You have one that's published in the 20s. You have one that's published around 1900. You have just a handful, three or four, that are published in the 30s, a couple published in the 50s, and then, like I say, and Scott Momaday published his Housemaid of Dawn in 68, and then, boom, Leslie Silko, Jim Welsh, Louise Erdrich, Gerald Visner, Rippy Slipperjack. Suddenly there's just a great kind of an explosion, not a large explosion, but a pretty substantial explosion given the past literary field. So it,
I guess you'd have to include some of your books as well.
Yeah, I always let somebody else do that, but yeah. Sure, I mean, I'm writing right within that group.
When was your earliest book?
1990. I started late being serious about my writing. I was doing other other things, traveling around the countryside, trying to figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up. Got into education, and I guess when I went to Lethbridge in Canada, I had nothing much else to do there. It's a small town, and I was playing basketball with an all-native team, and some of that stuff sort of just fermented inside, and I thought, well, I could do some short stories. Got nothing better to do. I'll do some short stories. I sort of wrote three short stories about the same set of characters, and when I finished the third short story, I said, hey, you know, maybe I've got a novel here. Maybe I could just try to shoot for that. And so that became Medicine River, which was my first piece. And that was in 90, published in 90. And then I worked on Green Grass, Running Water, and also did a children's book for the Columbus Quincentennial. Most of us were buried under requests for something on Christopher Columbus. I think every native writer in the world wound up having somebody call them up and say, you know, would you do a magazine article for us or would you do a book? And I'd said no to all those, as many of us did, just because it just didn't seem to be, you know, particularly profitable in terms of time to do that, because everybody else was jumping on, you know, Columbus as a great guy or Columbus as a real jerk. So many of us stayed away from that particular game. But
well, Michael Doris wrote one. It was published last year. It was a young adult book. I read it. It was quite nice.
They published two, as a matter of fact. He published the one young adult reader book, which was called,
I think, Evening Star, something like
Morning
that.
Star,
Morning
Star, maybe?
Morning Star.
Afternoon Star.
Something like that.
Yeah, and he and Louise Erdrich also published Crown of Columbus,
right,
which was sort of in that same area. I came home and was complaining about all these requests for Christopher Columbus, and my son, who's now seven, my youngest son, who's 7 years old, said, why don't you write about Columbus? And I said, well, I don't want to write about Columbus. Everybody's writing about Columbus. He says, no. He says, why don't you write about Coyote and Columbus, who is a trickster figure? And I thought, well, that's not a bad idea. So I produced a kid's book called Coyote Columbus Story, which was only published in Canada. So that's sort of the second one, along with Green Grass, that came out in the same year. So that's been pretty much it. I've got an anthology, and I've got a collection of short stories coming out in the fall. But this is really just the second novel.
Tell me about your background, because you are a Native American.
Yeah, Cherokee on my father's side. That's pretty simple. I was born and raised in Northern California, central Northern California. My father was out of Oklahoma, met my mother during the war out in California, and just pretty normal childhood.
So you were born in California?
Born in California.
Where were you born?
You know where Roseville is?
No.
It's near Sacramento,
mm-hmm.
But up in the foothills, mm-hmm. a little ways. So it's sort of upper valley kind of life, that California Central Valley area. So born and raised around there.
Did you grow up being aware that you had a Native American background?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't of any import when we were kids, because the neighborhood I was raised in was a lot of Mexican Americans in the neighborhood. Roseville's a railroad town, and it's really divided up into two sections. One is where, you know, the ethnic people more or less live, and the other section was where anybody who wasn't ethnic lived. And one side was poor and one side was rich, and it was very easy to keep track of people in that town, because the railroad tracks truly did divide it up. And I mean, we knew who our father was, and, you know, we sort of knew who each other was in the neighborhood, but it really didn't make any difference. And it didn't make any difference in any great way until we became teenagers. And then we'd get out of that neighborhood where we were known, and people would say, well, who are you? And they'd look at my brother and me, and they'd say, well, you know, where you come from? And at that point, we'd say, well, you know, we're Greek on my mother's side, and my father's Cherokee. Oh, really, Cherokee? So, and I think what happens with people who wind up in those situations, at some point, I think everybody takes on an identity. And sometimes it's just, you know, you don't even think about it. It's because of who you are and who your relatives are and all of that. In some other instances, you sort of make decisions, unconscious decisions sometimes. Especially for mixed bloods, I think that's true. So we've always known of ourselves as Cherokee, but it didn't make a big difference until, I guess, the 60s,
But you say your mother was Greek.
Mother's Greek, and Greek and German, actually. And the father's Cherokee. It's a great combination.
Well, William Lee Street Moon jumped on the bandwagon, too. He's only about 10% Native American, but he was so enthralled by it that he just had to adopt the name.
Yeah, I don't know much about that story.
He's Scots-Irish, I believe, for the most part.
I think so, for the most part. Lee Street Moon sort of just... Most of us know each other. I mean, most of us were sort of in the academic business of teaching Native studies. And those of us who write, I mean, it's a small community. And for years and years before the 60s came along, you know, we sort of knew of each other. And as the 60s came along, we got introduced. And so it's always interesting to see new people pop up sort of out of nowhere on that. Doesn't happen quite so much anymore. It used to be everybody wanted to be Indian. In the 70s, it was almost embarrassing how many Indians there were all of a sudden. Now the population's dropped down to a...
Well, I wanted to claim some Cherokee blood, but unfortunately it's just two cousins.
Two cousins?
Who are half Cherokee.
Oh,
From Oklahoma.
Where? What part of Oklahoma?
Tulsa.
Tulsa, okay, yeah.
My father's older brother married a Cherokee Indian woman.
Ah.
And had two children by her, and... their name, they have the same last name as I have, and strangely, they're both pilots.
Pilots?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, airline pilots.
Airline pilots. Well, one that works for a private company in Delaware, not DuPont. It was DuPont, but he switched companies. The other worked for Pan Am.
Well, I guess fear of flying doesn't run in Cherokee blood. I'm terrified of flying, but those two guys, if they fly, must have must have managed to get around that. I'm embarrassing on a flight.
You have white knuckles?
White knuckles isn't the word for what I get. when we flew into LaGuardia this time, we had to wait for the storm to clear. And so we were in fog and clouds, and it was very turbulent. And at a couple of points, I actually opened my mouth and just like that, and had people looking around their seats to see, you know, who was this guy? Was he in pain? Did he have a heart attack? What was wrong with him? And I had a hold of the seat and was just thankful when we got down on the ground and I could get into a cab, which also scared the hell out of me when we coming into town.
I'm sure your cabs are more dangerous than airlines.
I think so.
But it is scary. I just flew back from Texas a month or so ago, and the planes... flight path took us over Manhattan. Had a beautiful view of Manhattan.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic view. And then all of a sudden, it turned to go into LaGuardia, and it went through a heavy cloud cover.
Oh.
Right, you couldn't see anything. And there was a lot of turbulence at this point as we were making our approach, and it was really scary. Also, you're flying over houses, and you can almost reach down and touch them, you know, and it's really spooky.
No, that's not my idea of a good time at all. I have to make a book tour in another 2 weeks that takes me to, I think, 15 cities or 17 cities. And most of it, it's fly in the morning, do the print media and the radio and the television, read that night, go to bed, get up the next morning and fly. And my partner figures that by the time I get back to St. Paul, she's going to have to lock me in a closet for a week and just slip my food under the door until I calm down.
No, you'll be fine. After all of that flying, you'll be so professional about it that every little bump and thump you hear on the airline, you'll know what it is.
No, I won't. No, I won't. I'm going to be the same miserable flyer that I was when I started out.
Well, let's talk about green grass, running water.
Sure.
Four of the most interesting characters. There's a lot of interesting characters. It's actually a rather complex book with lots of people. But there are four... old Indians in the book. I can't remember. The Coyote is one. Lone Ranger. I can't remember.
Actually, Lone Ranger, Robinson Crusoe, Ishmael, and Hawkeye are the four old Indians. And then you've got Coyote and a narrator that never is really named,
who are
kicking around and sort of controlling the piece. Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about the episodes that punctuate this book, featuring these Indians and Coyote and so forth, because. I get the impression that this really goes back to the oral, rather mystical tradition of Native Americans.
Well, I've been toying with an idea about writing a novel about 2 years ago, and I wanted to write something that was semi-historical. But as I said, there were problems with writing historical novels for Native writers. And so I hit upon the idea that if I was going to do anything that was historical at all, I was going to have to first try to make history my own. And as I said to myself, okay, what does that mean? I thought, well, I suppose the best way to do it is to create the world and begin with that. And so I took oral creation stories and more or less, I suppose, adapted them or used some of the structures and some of the ideas in oral creation stories to start this novel off, and just simply decide I'd recreate the world. And I'd recreate the world this time in along more native patterns, as I understood them. And decided that I needed to have a cast of characters who would look after the world once I got it created. It wasn't enough to create it. You had to have some kind of maintenance control on the world. And so the four old Indians are that. They sort of begin at the very beginning of time, and by the time we meet them, of course, they're in a mental hospital because no one knows really what to do with them. But they escape from the mental hospital whenever they feel like it. I think it's 37 times at this point that we know of by the time we catch them, and they go off to try to set the world straight again. It's messed up. They're in part responsible for it. They keep trying to make it better. They make it better. Sometimes it gets worse. They really don't have much control over exactly what happens, which is true with oral creation stories, too. There aren't any omnipotent deities, for the most part, in oral creation stories. There are a cast of characters who help to set the world up, and the results that they get are mixed. And so the same thing happens in Green Grass Running Water, except that this time we're in the 20th century in contemporary times, and the old Indians wind up in a place called Blossom, Alberta. And through happenstance, they decide that they're going to help this one particular character, Lionel Red Dog, with his life. And Lionel needs it. He sells televisions and stereos in a shop in Blossom, Alberta, a place called Buffalo Bursum's Home Entertainment Barn. And the last thing that Lionel wants is help with his life, and what he's going to get are the old Indians trying to help him straighten it out with some rather interesting results for Lionel and for the novel itself.
Well, you populate the book with very realistic characters, too. There's Lionel's cousin, Charlie, mm-hmm. who's a lawyer.
Yep.
Their mutual female interest, whose name escapes me?
Alberta Frank.
Alberta.
Well, and of course, there's Eli Stands Alone.
Eli Stands yeah. Alone, who has a little house which is threatened by a dam yeah. close by.
There,
is it Letitia?
Letitia Red Dog, who runs the Dead Dog Cafe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the cast of characters really are some of the in disguise, I suppose, some of the major issues that that face Native people in Canada and the U.S. Eli Stands Alone and the concern over the dam and the concern over Native land rights and sovereignty and, you know, who controls Indian land is probably one of the biggest issues, and it's an issue that affects me and that affects my writing. And so this book really was to be in some ways a history lesson. The title itself comes from some of the treaty language that promised that these treaties would be in effect as long as the grass is green and the waters run. So it is, I suppose, a kind of literary history lesson. And the characters themselves, you know, fulfill particular roles that look at bits and pieces of Native history and some of the concerns that face Native people today. So it's very different than, say, Medicine River, which is pretty much a straightforward story and probably very different than other things I'll do in the future. But you start getting ideas like, you know, the Dead Dog Cafe, which is a favorite of mine just because of that joke about Indians eating dog. And so that's what they sell at this cafe. You know, they tell all the tourists that it's dog meat, Black Labrador to be exact. And you have these pictures of those old hunting photographs from the 19th century, you know, that used to have two fishermen with a stick between them and hundreds of trout hanging down, or the old pictures from Africa with a guy in the pith helmet standing over the head of a lion that he's just shot. And in this case, all the pictures in the cafe are Indians and dogs. So they've got Indians on ponies chasing down herds of Great Danes. and Indians with this great pole between them with doshans hung like sausages on it. And so it's an ethnic joke in some ways, and it's set up in part, I suppose, to diffuse some of the cliches and the stereotypes that I think Americans and Canadians, you know, still have in their heads, even if they don't want to say them out loud.
Well, these cliches and stereotypes are personified by a television, by a movie on television that keeps running through the book. And well, tell me a little bit about that, because these early commercial westerns.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't just Indians that were stereotyped. Obviously, almost everybody was stereotyped.
Yeah. The problem with those, as I look back on them, I just saw one last night, as a matter of fact, with Jimmy Stewart in it, where Stewart, I think it was Stewart, maybe it wasn't, my eyes aren't what they used to be, but it was a mountain man, and they had the Indians, you know, with full feather headdresses out in the bush, you know, holding up their hands to say how, and just the general standard stuff. The problem with those movies for me is that even though you have some stereotyping going on with cowboys and with mountain men and Indian fighters and whatnot, most of the non-native characters are really what E.M. Forster used to call round characters. They have a full range of emotions, whereas the Indians really were kind of stock characters, and there were a number of ways in which you could call out an Indian in those movies. You could dress them up, you know, to look like an Indian, which meant feathers and loincloth, or feathers and buckskin. And it was pretty easy to identify Indians. They didn't do much except work as background or as foils for the white characters in the piece. So, and that particular movie that you talk about, that's in the book, it'll be interesting to see how many people think that's a real movie. Okay, that I'm actually using a real movie, because I'm not. I have no idea if John Wayne and Richard Widmark ever appeared in a movie like that together. But it doesn't make any difference, because they could have. And those movies run together so hard on each other that you'd have to be a movie aficionado to be able to say, you know, no, this is John. He's created this movie. Because you've got, you know, Box Canyons, you have Indians charging across the river, you have the cavalry coming over the top of the rise behind them and saving our heroes, except for one instance. And so you have all of those sort of beats that are a part of that. But it's not a real movie at all. I mean, if it is, I mean, maybe somebody will call up and say, listen, it is a real movie. It was made in 1948. It stars. I'm going to feel like a real jerk. But it's just that part of the novel that sort of gets repeated, that here's a stereotype, here's a cliche, here's the way in which we can undermine that and look at it in a different way. Here's some fun we can have, you know, that all of us can have with it. Because one of the things about humor for me is, if humor has an object, if humor laughs at someone or something, then it's not particularly good humor as far as I'm concerned. If humor can get us all laughing about something that we do or something that we believe, and, you know, through that laughter you come to a better understanding of some of the problems inherent in that, then that's good humor as far as I'm concerned. I don't like humor that laughs at someone. So you get, you know, half the characters laughing at the other half of the characters. And I like that sort of shared, that befuddlement that gets shared around with all the characters.
Well, speaking of movies, there have been a couple of good ones lately. One of the best was Black Robe. Did you see that one?
Yeah, I saw that. That was quite an interesting movie. There was some real difference of opinion within the Indian community on whether or not that was a good movie or not. But aside from a couple of scenes that I thought were a little romantic and a little bit overdone, I was fairly impressed with that. I thought that there was a scene at the very beginning of that movie where you see Champlain's men getting dressed, and you see the Indians getting dressed, you know, putting on mm-hmm. their good clothes, and there it cuts back and forth between those two groups, you know, showing them painting their faces, showing them, you know, getting their mustaches fixed up, to where it doesn't privilege either one of the groups. It puts them on the same level. And I thought that was very effective in Black Robe, probably as effective a scene as I've seen in movies.
Well, it humanized all the characters in the movie. And indeed, it made the priest Black Robe himself, not a very attractive character, whereas the Indians were.
Yeah. For me, it started working its way back towards more standard fare towards the end, but certainly all the way through the first, say, 5/8 of that movie. I was watching it as a lesson in some of the things that you can do, and quite impressed with what they had accomplished. I'm so used to going to the films, you know, where they're going to say, you've got to go and see something like Dance with the Wolves. You know, it's a whole new remake, and I go and see Dance with the Wolves.
There were some reverse stereotypes in Dances with Wolves, where the cavalry, they were so patently bad. I don't think there were any redeeming members among the army officers.
Yeah, which is silly, which is really stupid, because if you have straw men like that, it's easy to hate them, it's easy to dismiss them. And they even have the Pawnees, that one Pawnee Indian played by Wes Studi, who is so bad that it's almost unbelievable. That was a problem for me on the movie. I like to see characters that are well drawn, that have some balance to them. But once again, I mean, it's Dance with Wolves is, for all of the interesting things they do with Indian humor, for example, it really becomes a remake of A Man Called Horace, Little Big Man, When the Legends Die, a whole series of movies that have come before it. When I came out of the movie, I said to myself, if I see another non-Indian riding to the rescue of Indians and saving us from ourselves, I'm going to scream. And I think it continues sort of that idea, which is a very intriguing idea. I mean,
the Indians came to the rescue of Kevin Costner, as you recall.
Well,
he was being carted off to the stockade in chains and being brutalized by his captors to boot.
Yeah, but it's Costner really who saves them, provides them with the rifles. And at the end, there's that sort of romantic ending where we know the Indians aren't going to fare very well, but Costner and the female lead are going to be okay if they can just get away. It wasn't a particularly satisfying movie for me overall, although I liked parts of it. I certainly liked the jokes that they gave to the Indian characters. Floyd Westerman, the two guys arguing who's going to go and talk to Kevin Costner, and that there's the two of them saying that Floyd should not go and talk, and Floyd saying, yes, I shouldn't go, but you guys should go. There were some nice moments in the film, but Black Robe was a much more satisfying film overall.
Certainly more difficult film.
And more difficult film. Much more difficult film, and a film that took more chances. Yeah, Breen Moore's novel, Canadian writer.
Actually, he is Irish. Lives in California.
Does he live in California now?
Mm-hmm.
He was in Canada for a long time.
I believe he was. He was a newspaper man in Montreal for a period of time.
Yeah. Canadians think of him as Canadian.
But he's actually Irish. He still has his brogue. I have interviewed him.
I've not met him. I just... running around with literary types in Canada, you sort of wind up knowing who's considered Canadian and, you know, who's not. Some strong nationalism in Canada, so you have to keep a scorecard on that.
Well, let's get back to green grass, running water, because we're almost out of time. There were a couple of things. They explain this a little bit. There were a lot of fantasy elements to the book, and here we have these disappearing cars leaving behind just a puddle of water. Tell me about that.
Well, that's... That was a conceit that I started with and wasn't sure what I was going to... I had something else in mind when I started out. And actually, the kinds of cars... I won't give it away. I don't want to ruin it for people. But I had something else in mind when I started off on the cars. And then the cars began to be much more than I had intended them to be until they became sort of... colonizing vehicles, if you will, or a part of that that colonizing mentality. I don't know why the cars turned out the way they did. I started off with Babbo's car disappearing, who's a janitor at the mental hospital, and it just sort of grew until it became what it winds up in the book. Kind of fun. And I suppose you could argue that, as one person did already when they were talking to me, that was this my the intent that I'm sort of loading on to the automobile all of the load of this civilization, of bringing civilization forward, as had been brought forward to this continent by ships, for example, before. I hadn't thought about that. It just was kind of a running joke that I sort of caught on to part of the way through.
Well, you don't have to explain it.
Yeah, actually,
I don't think an author has to explain every element. He probably doesn't even know every element.
That's the truth. People who have been teaching Medicine River, who know the book better than I do, come up and ask me questions I never even had considered, but I can see where they came to that conclusion. I think the same thing's going to hold true for Green Grass, Running Water, because it's a much more complex novel structurally and in its intent. So,
I was talking to Doris Lessing not too long ago.
Oh.
There have been a lot of scholarly books and articles
yes,
about
there
her.
Yeah.
And she's read them to her bafflement. She said, I meant to say all of that. I had no idea. I thought I was just telling a story.
It makes us feel very smart. It really does. And I think if you really put the question to many writers, I think I would say I don't mind it. I don't mind it. It makes me feel almost important sometimes with some of the things that people say. I mean, when Margaret Atwood says of you that your comedy is wonderful, you know, you think, oh, my comedy must be wonderful then. So it's...
And those were the serious lines she was talking
those
about.
Those were the serious lines, right.
Now we have, all through the book also, we have reoccurrences of the Sundance.
Yes.
And that seems to be, tell me a little bit about that. That seems to be a very important ceremony.
It is for the Plains tribes. The Sundance is a very important ceremony. It's kind of a culmination that brings all the people together. It's not only a spiritual ceremony, but it's also a communal ceremony, at least up on the Blood Reserve in Alberta. There is not just a coming together of the dancers themselves and the families that support the dancers, but at particular times you have the entire community coming out there to watch and support the dance for those public moments of the ceremony. And for me, it wasn't the Sundance itself, because I take great pains not to describe the Sundance in any great detail. I try to stay away from that and describe life in the Sundance camp itself. But it's that, it is that communal moment where Indian people, in this novel at least, come together, put their differences aside, and come together as a as an ethnic group, as a cultural group. And it's one of the ways in which they hold on to who they are. And it's done every year. It just, you know, comes around. And so in that sense, from the standpoint of a writer, it's a critical ceremony. Not for its spirituality, but simply for that that social coming together, that communal spirit that's embodied in the Sundance.
There seems to be an outsider's obsession with taking photographs.
Oh, yes, yes. Everyone takes photographs of Indians and things that you don't understand. And some of the tribes don't mind you taking pictures of parts of the Sundance. I mean, it varies from tribe to tribe. On the Blood Reserve, they don't want cameras there, and most of the time people, you know, will not bring cameras there. But you'd be surprised with the advent of video cameras in particular. You know, people really do feel as though they have a right to sit up on a hill, for example, and just photograph whatever they want to. And that's happened, and people even sneaking up across the prairies with telephoto lenses to take pictures of the ceremonies that are out in the open. Which baffles me, because what do you do with those? I mean, of what importance could those possibly be to someone who doesn't participate and doesn't even understand the Sundance? But there was a great appetite for the exotic and the erotic, I think, in America. And I suppose that's what it all is a part of. But it also is, for me in the novel, it's also a way in which a culture can be set upon, and in some ways brutalized, or in some ways try to be appropriated. And that incident where the guy comes into the camp with a station wagon and begins taking pictures is really sort of that wanting to sort of help himself, thinking that this is available for general consumption. And even after, you know, they're told that it isn't, there is that anger that comes with sort of being denied something that you really think is available to you. So it's sort of all wrapped up in that. But it is an important ceremony, not for the ceremony itself, but for what it says about the people and about the community.
So you taught for 10 years in Alberta? Huh?
Taught for 10 years in Alberta, yeah. I was with the Native Studies Department there at University of Lethbridge.
And there is a large Indian community around there.
There is. It's probably the largest Native Studies department in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And the largest reserve in Canada is just off campus. You can jump in a car and drive out there in about a half an hour. Or if you're adventurous, you can just cross the river and you're on Blood Land. So it was very close on and a large population. I played for an all-Native basketball team at one point because I was tall. I'm a lousy basketball player. I am frightfully bad. But they didn't care because I was big, and I could just stand in the center and sort of push guys around. That's where a lot of the stories actually come from, is just hanging out with that cast of characters who are better than anything I could write. Wonderful stories come out of that part.
These stories, I think you said, are going to be published in book form? Some
yeah.
of the characters that you met in Alberta will be appearing in this new collection?
Yeah. There's a new collection coming out in September, short stories, and there'll be some of those in there. Although some of them appear in Green Grass Running Water, too, in various guises. One of the things I think that fiction by Native writers is beginning to do is beginning to introduce non-Native readers to a wide cast of Indian characters. If you read just historical fiction, you're reading a very narrow cast of Indian characters. Now with contemporary fiction, you're beginning to see Indians in what you, I suppose, might consider to be non-traditional roles, which is very important for most of us. Otherwise, I mean, if you're a university professor, when I get introduced, people still kind of look at me and wonder, well, is this guy a real Indian? I mean, which is one of the questions, of course, that's asked in Green Grass Running Water, you know. How can you be a real Indian if you drive cars and if you speak English and if you are a university professor and if you do all of these things that are patently non-Indian? And the answer, of course, is that being Indian isn't a profession. It's something else. It's who you are.
I don't know, I don't have statistics, but I would assume that most Native Americans live in town now, not on the reserve.
I haven't seen the last stats on that. I suppose if you took Canada and the U.S. Just as a as an area, I would guess that the majority there would live in small towns, rural areas, and then maybe in the larger cities. But my bet would be that there's still a large population that live on reserves or outside of those city centers and those larger rural areas. I'm not dead sure about that, but you've got the Northwest Territories, you have the Navajo Reservation, you have a lot of people still in Oklahoma, a good many people up in the Dakotas and Montana. So I don't know what that would show. There must be, the census must have organized that in some way.
There's still an Indian reservation on Long Island, believe it or not.
Is there?
Yeah. I can't remember the name of the tribe. I guess you call them a tribe, but I know that many of them were involved in construction because they, unlike yourself, had no fear of heights.
I've got a friend of mine who's Mohawk who regales me with stories about working high steel in New York.
Right.
And as long as he doesn't do that during lunch, I'm all right.
Well, Thomas King, Green Grass, Running Water, it's a beautiful book, and I thank you very, very much for spending this time with me.
Thank you for having me.